The early bird catches the worm. Or a stitch in time saves nine. Those are some rather well-known English proverbs. But proverbs exist in all countries around the world and throughout recorded history. For example, fall seven times and stand up eight. That's a Japanese proverb, and I think it's strangely biblical sounding, isn't it? Measure a thousand times and cut once. That's a Turkish problem. Also sounds somewhat familiar. Maybe not the one you've heard, but familiar. This one I really like. A spoon does not know the taste of the soup, nor a learned fool the taste of wisdom. That's Welsh. Evil enters like a needle and spreads like an oak tree. Ethiopian. Don't sail out farther than you can row back. Everyone is kneaded out of the same dough. Oh, I forgot. Sorry. Don't sail out farther than you can row back. That's Danish. And then this next one is a Yiddish proverb. Everyone is kneaded out of the same dough, but not baked in the same oven. And then this last one, of course, you're going to know. As a man thinks, so is he. Proverbs 23:7. As I was reading through these, I started to wonder, why is it that proverbs have such a global appeal? Why does everyone have these proverbs? Why do we use them? Why do they exist? To a certain extent, they may encapsulate a lesson that appears to be rather obvious. Just to reconsider a few of these examples, fall seven times and stand up eight. One lesson we can glean from this is the importance of perseverance. If we prepare ourselves for many failures, we can coach our response to be a resilient response. Instead of giving up, we get up and continue. Measure a thousand times and cut once. We might suggest this is encouraging us to be prepared. And significantly different from the familiar English adage to measure twice and cut once. In this case, it's measure a thousand times. Don't just be prepared, be prepared. And this next one has really grown on me since I stumbled across it. A spoon does not know the taste of soup, nor a learned fool the taste of wisdom. Which, something in there reminds me of Proverbs 4:7. The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom, and with all your acquiring, get understanding. With some careful thought, I think we can take from it this image of a fool that remains a fool even when surrounded by wisdom, just as a spoon doesn't cease being a spoon simply because it's immersed in soup. And furthermore, it implies a next step for us, namely that if we would take action to not be fools, we cannot only be hearers of the word, we must be doers of the word. That's a lot of information packed into such a compact package. Evil enters like a needle and spreads like an oak tree. This goes beyond the obvious warning you might imagine about the need to avoid evil. Evil is bad. It really emphasizes the insidious nature of evil, how it can pierce the smallest crevice of your defenses, but then can grow to completely overwhelm you. Don't sail out farther than you can row back. I really enjoy this one a lot, particularly, I think it just has a humorous feel to it. Not only does it warn of the importance of planning ahead and being prepared for trouble, it does so in a way that leaves an image in your mind of that person who did not heed the warning, and they're now sitting out there in a becalmed sea with no way to get back to shore. And everyone is kneaded out of the same dough, but not baked in the same oven. If you were at all like me, you might have had to think about this for a bit. It took a bit of time for me to process. I would sum it up by saying that we're all human, we're that same dough, but our experiences shape us in ways that make each of us unique. And again, as a man thinks, so is he. I like that it highlights how much our minds affect our actions and our character. And so we see that these respective proverbs tell us that they tell us a number of things. If you get an early start, you'll find success. Perseverance is important, as is precision. We should be aware of evil. We should be cautious. Our experiences shape us. Our thoughts shape us. But what's the difference between the original or between these simple statements I just made, these quick summaries, and the more pictorial proverbs? Why does one sound simple and kind of forgettable, and the other one is catchy and sticks with us? And my personal hypothesis has two parts. One is that these proverbs tell actually a deep tale, not just a surfacey bit of advice. And two, they do so in a way that engages the mind and forces you to really process a bit. And then it becomes a shorthand for a much larger story. And what we want to focus on here is this distinction between things that are easy to see, easy to judge, easy to dismiss. And there are the things that take us effort, but that may be far richer in their reward. Sometimes the key to finding a valuable gem of truth lies in reframing our situation. So we're going to take a look at such a problem. In the image you see before you is a firefighting helicopter, a river, and a house in flames. And your task is to find the most efficient, and by that I really mean the shortest path, the most direct path, from where the fire helicopter is currently stationed. You want to head to the river to fill up a bucket, and then head to the house to put out the flames. What's the best course? Is it to head directly down to the river? Or should maybe we find some midpoint between the helicopter and the house? How do we go about solving this problem? I'll give you a moment just to think about it. How would you find the most direct path? It's not uncommon to see this problem in a calculus course. One potential solution involves labeling the various distances as shown. You could perhaps draw in some triangles, add some formulas. You could do some calculus, differentiate, minimize the result. As you can see from the details I've added, it can get cumbersome quite quickly. It can require a bit of advanced mathematics. Oh, and by the way, if any of you are actually checking if this is the direct solution, I've left out a lot of details in the interest of time. So this is not even all of it. But we can also solve this by reframing the problem. What if we move the house to the exact opposite side of the river, like so? Do you now have an intuition about what the best path would be? In fact, what's interesting is that intuition is totally correct in this case, but it also gives you some insight into the best path that we were looking for before without all of the mathematics. Sometimes what our brains most need is a nudge to look at things in a different way. And this is where we come to the core of our thoughts. During a testimony meeting several months ago, one sister in our class was praising the qualities of another sister. And I don't remember the exact statement she made, but it included something a little along the lines of, I get discouraged when I find that I can't measure up to this other sister's wonderful example. And I'm sure I'm paraphrasing that not quite right, but I think the general sentiment shows through. I think this is not an uncommon feeling. I think you would agree that we all at times have been tempted to look at this type of situation in a similar manner. But is there a way we can reframe the situation that is positive instead of negative to help us deal with it? A way to turn it from a mind-numbing problem into a clear and useful solution for us. When we're faced with someone who we find possesses admirable qualities, instead of permitting the flesh to focus on our failures, could we instead aspire to improve that specific aspect of our character? Could we consider how lucky we are to learn lessons from them and to consider them part of our spiritual family? Could we search within ourselves for our unique element that others aspire to? What we're faced with here is a struggle between the flesh and the spirit. When the flesh is in control, jealousy and envy can make me frustrated that someone else has talents I do not. Or perhaps it can make me feel unworthy, which can lead to hopelessness. Meanwhile, where the spirit is in control, the appreciation of the talents of my brethren leads me to love that brother or sister even more, possibly to seek to learn from them and to emulate them in the spirit of love. At times like this, I like to reflect on the fact that we are all one body. And let us focus on the very familiar passage from 1 Corinthians 12. We don't have time to read the entirety of it, although we'll read quite a bit. It's all worth reviewing. But let's look at a few portions, beginning with verses 4 through 6 of 1 Corinthians 12. There are different kinds of spiritual gifts, but they are the gifts of the same Spirit. There are different spheres of service, but the service is of the same Lord. There are different kinds of effects, but it is the same God who produces them in every case and in every person. This is an excellent reminder that our gifts and service and the effects we produce in His service are all going to be unique. It's a very human tendency to compare ourselves to others, but that is not God's way. We see God's way as we continue reading, skipping to verses 14, and we're going to read several here, 14 through 26. The body does not consist of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I'm not part of the body, that does not make it any less the part of the body. If the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I am not part of the body, that does not make it any the less part of the body. If the whole body was an eye, what would happen to the sense of hearing? If the whole body was an ear, what would happen to the sense of smell? But in point of fact, God has appointed each part in the body as he wished. If all the parts of the body were one part, where would the body be? The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you, nor, to take another example, can the hand say to the feet, I don't need you. So far from that, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker are in fact more essential. We attach greater honor to those parts of the body which we regard as dishonorable. The unlovely parts of our body are surrounded with a greater modesty, of which the lovely parts have no need. But God has blended the body together and has given more honor to the parts which lack honor. His design was that there might be no division in the body, but that the parts of the body should be equally concerned for each other's welfare. So if one part of the body suffers, all the parts suffer in sympathy with it. And if one part is honored, all the parts share its joy. Think about that passage from the perspective of our self-critical nature. Those very moments where we may be engaged in negative self-talk, at those times, we are permitting the flesh to run counter to the spirit described above. This is another one of those metaphors similar to the Proverbs we began with today. On the surface, we could say, we all benefit from our group diversity. It's a very simple statement. I think we agree with it. We benefit from group diversity. But just like the simple statements I described at the beginning, it's very forgettable. How much more memorable and impactful is it to hear that we are one body? And that, of course, a foot and a hand and an eye have different forms and functions, but are all intrinsically valuable to the working of the whole. That isn't just a statement made to make you feel better when you're feeling down. You observe the truth in that statement every day. You can't pick up your coffee cup with your eye, nor can your nose tell you when the doorbell rings. And of course, we know in our hearts and minds that we are one body, but that doesn't stop the flesh from wheedling its way into our thoughts and pulling us down the wrong mental road. In fact, isn't that what the Ethiopian proverb was saying back at the beginning? Evil enters like a needle and spreads like an oak tree. That is exactly how the voice of the flesh grabs a hold of you. In addition to being one body in 1 Peter 2, we are likened to living stones. 1 Peter 2, verse 5, as if you yourselves were living stones, and you must let yourselves be built into a living temple, in which you will become a holy priesthood. I was reminded of that verse when I was reading the following passage from Reprint 5650. Our faith and our trust in the Lord and his gracious promises should be so strong and unwavering that they will far more than counterbalance the oppositions of the world, of false brethren, and of Satan's blinded servants. So implicit should be our faith and our Father's love and care that all these persecutions will be recognized and rejoiced in as the agencies of his providence in chiseling, shaping, and polishing us as living stones for the glorious temple which he is constructing, and which is now so soon, we believe, to be set up. Just as we are one body, we are also living stones being fashioned by the master builder into a living temple. And as Brother Russell describes in this passage, we expect that chiseling and shaping and polishing will do their work in us. We start on our journey as rough stones fresh from the quarry. It's only after being worked with that we gain the smooth faces, the upright corners, and the straight edges that permit us to fit seamlessly with our brethren. And that's not now. It's our future destination. But we can take some lessons from it. Right now, we know we're still in an unfinished state. We're at different stages of development. Some of us have been worked with for many years, and those ones appear to the rest of us as well-formed and sleek and polished stones, nearly ready to be set in place. And others of us have only recently been plucked from the quarry. There's some potential there, but it's potential maybe only the master really sees the true extent of. But I ask you, Is it the stone's place to pick and choose which ones are fit to be part of the Lord's temple? We look at one another, and it's easy for our eyes to get caught on those shiny bits that others have. We focus so hard on our rough spots, our own failures and our struggles. So when we see the well-polished and shiny bits possessed by another, we sometimes feel they reflect poorly on ourselves. That's the obvious story. That's the one our mind fixates on. But if we reframe the problem, we can see we're all useful stones. We represent a variety of body parts. We're not looking for uniformity or even necessarily similarity. Through God's great wisdom, all these strange and disparate parts, eyes, ears, noses, arms, legs, organs, the individual cells that underlie it all are destined to come together into a whole that is altogether more functional than any of the parts on its own. Not only that, but from looking at any of the parts in isolation, you would never have a clue what that final product actually was going to look like. So perhaps by now I've convinced you we don't benefit from comparing ourselves with one another or from competing to be better in various aspects of service. It's not enough. Our flesh, our mind is really good at falling into old habits. To illustrate this, I'm going to tell you the story of the speeding ticket. Approximately 25 years ago, a much younger Nathan was driving to the General Convention in St. Joseph, Missouri. He was driving a van with maybe 5 or 6 other young adults, and this van was literally in the middle of nowhere, in the long open spaces somewhere between Albuquerque and Denver. When he realized those lights back there was someone coming to pull him over for speeding. Now, this much younger version of myself felt his heart drop in his chest. For all of his faults, he was generally a by-the-book rules follower. This had never happened before. And to make matters worse, he was in a car full of late teens, early 20-somethings who were not going to let this opportunity go without a load of teasing. And for the rest of that trip, I assure you, he was driving right at the speed limit or else trying to convince someone else to do the driving. Now, on the scale of traumatic life events, I realize this does not place very high. But I assure you, at that time, it felt quite traumatic. I felt like I would never drive above the speed limit ever again. I'm suspecting you have a rough idea of where this story is headed. I'm not going to tell you about another speeding ticket, although I've had a few over the years. But what I really want to focus on is just how long would you guess that that fear and carefulness and vigilance lasted? If I had to estimate, I'd say at most 2 months. I probably kept a better eye on things, and it's true, I probably never went that fast again. But what I really want to focus on here is that even when we know what we should be doing, even when we know why we're doing it and what the consequences might be, that flesh still tugs at us. It does it daily. And so we're good today, and we're good the next day and the next day. But one day, we let it slip just a little, and a little becomes a little more, and so on. And isn't that the same way with our vigilance over the flesh? There are many blessings associated with conventions, but I find one of the more important ones for me is this refreshing of my memory about all the things that have slowly started to fade away. And I appreciate the reminders of the importance of vigilance. I appreciate the reminders of our unity of purpose. I appreciate the reminders of God's precious promises. I'm reminded of Moses going up in the mountain and returning to the people with his shining face. We may not be physically glowing when we leave a convention, but I know the time spent in fellowship and study with the brethren certainly leaves me feeling refreshed and fully centered again. We know from an intellectual standpoint that we all contribute to the diverse body of Christ, but we must continually work to internalize that understanding. 1 Peter 5:8, you must be abstemious, restrained. You must be on the alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. It is altogether too easy to slip into old habits of negative self-talk and self-criticism. I'm not trying to suggest that we don't keep an eye on our own behavior, but rather that we dwell on the effort to improve rather than the opposite tendency, which can be more like wallowing. And that leads to another saying. I won't call this one a proverb because I don't think it hides any deeper truth. Rather, in this case, I think it represents a bit of a cynical view of life. And that saying is, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Now, I happen to believe we have plenty of evidence to the contrary for this one. In fact, we're disproving it right now online because I assure you that for many of you, using Zoom qualifies as a new trick. For many years, it was accepted wisdom that your brain ceased changing when you reached adulthood. But in recent years, science has come to the conclusion that the brain is capable of changing based upon our experiences. This ability to change is known as neuroplasticity. Our actions and behavior travel various pathways through our brains. It's something similar to a hiking trail. The trails that are traveled more are therefore more familiar, more well-worn, they're easier to navigate. Occasionally, we reach a point where we need to blaze a new trail. Maybe there are some new goals in our life, new circumstances. The only way we can meet, for example, is online via Zoom. And then we start hiking down this new mental path. And at first it's challenging, but gradually you traverse the path again and again until someday it starts to become as comfortable and familiar as the old path. Now that's only the start of the story. Your brain still remembers that old path. And the minute you stop thinking about it, or the minute you find it safe to meet in person again, your new skills will start to wither and dwindle. This is why my speeding ticket didn't completely change my future behavior. It's why we find it so difficult to keep New Year's resolutions. In order to cement this new behavior, we need to take conscious action. The first step is that you have to care about making the change. In the case of us meeting via Zoom, we certainly care for the moment because we value the connection with our brethren. And there are some wonderful added perks that we didn't anticipate, such as the possibility of our brethren joining us live from Europe and Africa and Australia. And yet, assuming this craziness eventually dies down, do we care enough about Zoom to maintain its use? In order to truly make a sustained behavioral change, we have to care enough to pursue that change diligently. The second step is really to really study the difference between the actions you're currently taking and the actions you would like to take. Returning to our example about those shiny bits that we see in our brethren and that we sometimes feel we're lacking, we need to recognize our tendency to be critical of self and overly emphasize attributes in others we may crave. We need to identify our tendencies versus our desired behavior. And then the third step is to manage expectations. When we go into a situation expecting to have an argument, for example, we are much, much more likely to argue. When we go into a situation expecting to fail, we're more likely to fail. And so we need to exert effort to develop positive self-talk, wherein we expect good things to come of our efforts. And the fourth step is to focus and to refocus. We have to keep coming back to Zoom week after week. We have to remind ourselves that these positive qualities in others are something we should be celebrating and affirming and nothing to be bringing us down. We have to continue to remind ourselves of these things, maybe through notes and through reminders, maybe through our testimony. The minute your brain gets a chance, it will jump back to the old ways and the old paths. And so you have to always keep it under control. Which brings us back to one of the Proverbs we mentioned at the very beginning. As a man thinks, so is he. Our brains have a great deal of control over our behaviors and tendencies. Through conscious effort, we can mold them in directions we find more beneficial. So let us return our thoughts to the three goals mentioned earlier. When we see these shiny bits in others, we should seek to light a fire in our hearts to develop that same talent in ourselves. It doesn't have to be a competition. It can be a motivation. We see this kind of behavior in children. How many schoolyard kids have thrown themselves into their passions in an attempt to become the next Michael Jordan or Michael Phelps or Simone Biles? Can we approach a self-overhaul with a positive heart? Can we find a character trait in others that we wish for ourselves and then watch and try to learn from them? For God did not give us the spirit of cowardly fear. He gave us the spirit of power, of love, and of self-discipline. Here, Timothy is encouraging the brethren to not shrink from the work of the faith. In their day, the fight was against persecution for that faith, and they need to be strong in their faith to combat it. Today, we have less overt persecution. Today, we fight to keep our minds right. We have to rein in the flesh to keep it on a tight leash and to focus on the destination that is most important to us. If we do it from the correct motivation, we're told in Matthew 6:33, make the kingdom of God and life in loyalty to him the object of all your endeavor, and you will get all these other things as well. Can we turn our thoughts away from our perceived inadequacies and instead direct them toward the wonderful brethren we have and this body of believers that is more than the sum of its parts? 2 Timothy 1, verses 3 through 5. I serve God with a good conscience, as my forefathers did before me, and I thank him when night and day I continually remember you in my prayers. I remember the tears you shed when we parted, and I am longing to see you again. Nothing can make me happier than that. I am reminded of the sincerity of your faith. Remembering our brethren in prayer can mean we pray for them, but it can also mean we give thanks for them. Think back again to 1 Corinthians 12. We who are many are one body, and the ear should not think that the foot is worthless. In fact, quite the opposite is true. In my mind, the ear and the foot should hold great respect for the qualities they each bring to the body as a whole. And let's stick with the ear and the foot a moment longer. Pretend for a moment that you're but a foot. Think of the fleshly and negative thoughts that might roll through your mind. One type of thought is what I would describe as the negative outward thought. That ear is not helping us walk around this room at all. And because of that, it's practically useless. Then there's the negative inward. As a foot, all I do is thump on the ground all day. I don't have the ability to hear lovely music like that ear does. Now, neither of those approaches is profitable. Rather, we could explore what I would describe as the positive outward, which we did a moment ago, how we value the ear, right? And equally important is the exploration of the positive inward, the recognition that I am also critical to this body. Can you imagine how hard it would be to limp around without me? What are some ways I as a foot could be even better at those tasks required of me? And if you find it difficult to find those attributes within yourself, just remember 1 Samuel 16:7. The Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. It is all too easy for us to be critical of ourselves, or actually of others. We must remember daily to redirect the thoughts to the positive. This can be through a little note on your mirror, through daily prayer, through our direct study. It is possible to retrain your brain, but it requires diligence above all else. And there's a final idea I'd like to add in here that's less about changing ourselves or our perspectives, and this step is to turn the lesson you've learned into an opportunity for service. And really, there are two parts to this. First of all, we recognize we have the ability to serve our brethren. When we accept our role, perhaps as a foot, we can then make it our mission to encourage others in their roles as well. We are not going through these struggles in isolation. 1 Peter 4:12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. And beyond this service mentality is room for even more growth. We can start to seek out opportunities to enable others to grow. I suppose you could describe this as management level service. You start out learning in the trenches, so to speak, and then you seek out others and you can direct them to avenues of opportunity. Only a few weeks ago, I was in conversation with a sister who I've known most of my life. We grew up attending conventions together, and she shared with me a story of a time when Brother Carl Hagensack reached out to her as a teenager to ask her if she would assist with some work on a project he was involved in. And so she stayed with the Hagensacks for a while, which I know, not a lot of surprise there, and gained a blessing from the opportunity. Now, she still remembers this, you know, I don't know, 20, 25 years later, and appreciates that opportunity. And in fact, that triggered another memory, another young Nathan story. I recall back in my teens coming up to the BSRC with some of my peers to assist in a painting effort. And I well recall these many years later, the days of painting and assisting Brother Frank Sirassi. I recall the sisters coming out and thanking us and providing us lemonade in the heat of the day. It was a mixture of hard work and pleasant fellowship, and it was utterly memorable. Sometimes people just need to be asked. This thought process all started with something of an offhand remark, one that was likely intended mostly with the focus of praise on another. But I think it reminds us of a frame of mind we can all identify with. I'm convinced that one of the greatest ways the Holy Spirit works in our lives is in helping us process these day-by-day decisions. As we ask for more of His Spirit, and as we practice retrieval from that portion of our minds, we will build those pathways and widen them and pave them and make them more familiar to us and build them into positive habits for the benefit of the entire body. And so we wish to remind you of the highlights that we'd like you to carry with you after this presentation ends. Sometimes reframing the problem can turn a messy situation into a clear one and can help us to see the best path. It's not always easy, but we have to look for those ways we can do so. And this reframing process takes a lot of practice. And it also requires the Holy Spirit, God's guiding will. And the closer we grow to Him and the more we practice, the easier it will be to walk those paths. We know that we need to be shaped and polished. We know all too well our own rough edges. And some of our rough edges even evade us, but maybe are painfully apparent, or many are painfully apparent. And we have a choice on how we deal with them. Do we become dejected because of those rough bits? Or do we seek instead to just work on polishing them? Do we feel jealousy toward those who have shiny bits? Or do we appreciate and applaud them? Do we avoid them because they remind us of our flaws? Or do we seek instead to emulate them and learn from them? Do we have unreasonable expectations for quick and easy growth or for perfection? Let me share with you another proverb, and this one is from Egypt. A beautiful thing is never perfect. It's an interesting one to think about. Brethren, if it was an easy path, it wouldn't be called the narrow way, right? To God be the glory.